surrogates are putting their sort of health and life on the line to help create families. And, you know, we have a duty as physicians, as healthcare providers, to minimize risks for them.
Welcome to Forces in Fertility, a podcast bringing together celebrity guests, fertility specialists, reproductive health advocates, and all people interested in empowering themselves and others, creating the next generation of life. This week, we are joined by a very special guest, Dr. Saeed Donishmand. I'm super excited to have him here, and what an awesome innovator in this space, in the fertility space. I'd love to throw it over to you, Dr. D, and have you introduce yourself.
Thank you so much. By the way, that was a great enunciation of my name, by the way. Thank you.
Must be the Persian background.
It must be. So yes, I'm Saeed Donishmand. I'm really honored and privileged to be a reproductive endocrinologist, a fertility specialist. Help create families for the last 25 years of my career. Did my training at UCLA, my residency, my fellowship, and undergraduate years. And really, I think it's been amazing. Every day I wake up and I feel like it's a privilege and honor. And I have so much gratitude for what, you know, all of us do, myself, the team that's around me. Help create families. You see the parents with their children and the joy in their eyes. And as a father of three daughters, frankly, it's inspirational. So we have a wonderful time every day because we work hard to create families, and colleagues such as Allkind and all the other colleagues that work hand in hand with us and accompany intended parents and surrogates and egg donors through this journey. Well, kudos to all of you.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about some of the points that you just touched on. Obviously, within your career, you work with, you know, intended parents, egg donors, sperm donors, surrogates, everybody kind of on this fertility journey. And really, initially, you were sort of drawn more towards the complex cases, which ultimately, sometimes when you're working with IVF patients who are a bit more complex, you're going to potentially lead to third-party medicine, third-party right. fertility. And so, you know, what initially drew you to working with more complex cases that ultimately sometimes end up leading to third-party?
I think it's probably one of two main reasons. Number one, I think there's an obstacle to be overcome in third party. In other words, when you look at, for example, gay intended parents, and you look at a subset of patients who haven't had the opportunity to create their families, you know, I'm in the United States, around the world, and we talk about access to care, we talk about access mm-hmm. to being able to build families. So I think the first thing is overcoming these obstacles is a challenge. I remember the first time I was in Paris giving a seminar to a group of intended fathers. I think we were 40, 50 of us. And as we left, you know, the courtyard where we're giving a seminar, we were pelted with eggs by a group of demonstrators who were against marriage equality. And I remember getting an email that night from one of my French intended fathers saying, "I'm so sorry, this was your welcome, first welcome." This was about maybe 20 years ago. First welcome to our country. And I said, no. This tells me this is exactly where I need to be. So I think one factor is to overcome the obstacles, which are very challenging, but it's wonderful to be able to overcome them mm-hmm. and be able to help people have and create their families that they weren't able to many, many years ago. So that's one issue. The other factor is the factor that led me to the field of reproductive endocrinology and fertility, and that is that it's intellectually stimulating. Mm-hmm. There are a great facets of physiology, anatomy that make reproductive endocrinology fascinating. And that's what drew me to the field. It was creation of families, intellectual stimulation. And of course, there's some surgical procedures that are involved, which you know, are refined surgeries that we do on a daily basis. So all of those factors combined, I think, drew me to not only the field of fertility, but even more complex cases too.
And when you're talking about some of those complex cases, you have a really sort of innovative approach to reproductive healthcare that we've seen both on, of course, working, you know, within the clinic, but also on the research end. And beyond that, I think when you talk about both research, medical facilities, and, you know, companies like Allkind, how do you see collaboration really playing a part in some of the trends that are coming within this space?
I think, you know, as someone who's being publishing papers and doing research for the last 27, 28 years. In fact, we've presented original research at the American Society of Reproductive Medicine now for 27 consecutive years. And really kudos to all the team members who've worked alongside of me to present these research papers. But a great deal of progress has been made in the field of reproductive endocrinology and infertility, for example, prevention of ovarian hyperstimulation syndrome, creating novel stimulation protocols to be able to retrieve good quality eggs, sperm retrieval techniques to be able to select out the best quality sperm based on DNA integrity. So as someone who's done research and who has also incorporated the research into practice, advance the science, advance the success rates, it's my responsibility of all my colleagues who do incredible research. And that's one of the advantages of doing research is you're surrounded by incredibly smart people who are innovating the field. And that is to be able to educate others, to share the information that we have gleaned from our research with our colleagues, so that, again, we can advance the science. Now, how do we advance the science? Not only do we increase and improve on the already incredible success rates, but we also make the process safer. For example, we published a series of papers looking at how we prevent ovarian hyperstimulation syndrome in the field of IVF. Back in the old days, ovarian hyperstimulation syndrome was fairly common. Now, with the use of novel trigger mechanisms, we've essentially eliminated that risk or significantly reduced it. So that was a series of papers that we published. And now I think egg donors and other patients who go through Bingo. The stimulation process can do it more safely.
Because that's a big concern that, you know, obviously you're seeing this all over now, TikTok, yes. Instagram, where one person has this bad experience,
right.
and they end up potentially in the hospital or something previously. And to know that we're working really, really diligently in this space to make it more safe for the right. donors, that's huge and makes us just feel so much more excited about the future.
Absolutely. Another area of advancement is that if we have pushed the sort of the limits of success, when we transfer a single good quality chromosomally normal embryo that's been genetically tested, I mean, some of the pregnancy rates we've been able to achieve is upwards of 80%. So mm-hmm. what does that do? That means we really have encouraged and insistent upon single embryo transfers. Mm-hmm. And by doing single embryo transfers, what we're doing is we're reducing the number of multiples, which then reduces the risks for surrogates, for our patients who go through the pregnancy. And again, we use the research to make the process, make the journey safer and more effective and more successful.
I'm really glad you touched on that because in previous years, especially when I first started in this space, a lot of the families that were going through third party, you know, were thinking, let's do multiple transfers with a surrogate candidate because then, you know, you get two children in one delivery. But ultimately, a lot of times the transfers either weren't successful right. or it just was riskier.
Sure.
And so to hear you saying that you primarily focus more on one embryo transfer now. Is that for all IVF patients?
IVF patients. I mean, you know, there's that well over 90% of my transfers are single embryo transfers, and I'd strongly encourage single embryo transfers for patients because twins have a much higher rate of complications, mm-hmm. premature birth
yeah.
for the neonates, you know, gestational diabetes for the surrogate, high blood pressure, postpartum hemorrhage. I mean, all of these things. Surrogates are putting their sort of health and life on the line to help create families. And, you know, Absolutely. We have a duty as physicians, as healthcare providers to minimize risks for them.
Absolutely. And kind of talking through this next question is a big one from our community. As you know, our community is growing with surrogates and egg yes. donors and sperm donors. And to get your perspective is so meaningful for them because they get to kind of see a glimpse into the clinic before they come.
That's true.
What is a piece of advice that you have for someone on the surrogate or donor side that's about to enter this exciting journey? And as you said, they're, you know, putting their bodies and right. their time
right.
into something that is so incredible for a family. And so true. What would be a piece of advice that you would give them?
I mean,
them?
The advice that I would have for surrogates, for, you know, future prospective surrogates and prospective egg donors is, you know, do your due diligence, the research that you should do in terms of the team mm-hmm. that you're going to be working with, yep. the agency that you're going to be working with, their reputation, their experience, their level of communication and how reactive they are to your needs, to your questions, to your concerns. And then from the, you know, physician perspective, from the medical perspective, again, doing research on the physicians that you're going to be working with, the nurses you're going to be working with, just make sure that they are from reputable backgrounds, have a great deal of experience in this field. And of course, having that academic background, the research background mm-hmm. also helps as well. These days, I think there's a lot of information that's available to patients online. And I think every patient has to be proactive with their care, including egg donors and surrogates, be able to really research the team that's going to be taking care of you mm-hmm. because, as I said, you know, they're placing their health on the line, egg donors and surrogates.
Yeah.
And there's a responsibility that all of us have to really take the very best care of them.
Absolutely. And that's one of the things too, that at All Kind is really important for us also, is working with reputable clinics and reputable agencies who do make that a priority. And the full journey is
yes.
to respect everybody's journey and treat everybody like a patient.
Yes.
So I love that you said that. It makes me feel really good. And just for the future of where fertility is heading to, very different from even just a few years ago.
That's true.
So
very true.
Very, very happy. What are some of the really rewarding aspects of your job that you feel like you make you excited to come back every day?
You know, I go to, we have reunions around the world because, you know, we've been able to have the privilege and honor of being able to not only help intended parents here in the US, but around the world as well. So when I go to Australia, when I go to Europe, when I'm in different cities around the world, and the children come in to see me with their parents, and I get to hug them, I get to take photos with them, I get to see them as they grow older. You know, we have, I remember one of my intended parents from France, you know, her son is now 24 years of age. And every year on his birthday, I get a photo of her and her son that I helped achieve their goal of creating her family. So I think that's the most rewarding part of the journey. And then, of course, I'm in contact via text, via WhatsApp with parents. And, you know, there's not a day that passes where I don't have photos of parents with their children, or photos of intended parents with their surrogates, you know, where they've reached milestones during the pregnancy. Mm-hmm. It's every day on text, and it's wonderful. And then we have the honor sometimes of some of the surrogates living closer to the clinic. So when the children are born, the newborns come into our office. My medical assistant, Mai, she's amazing. She will schedule a time for us to be able to greet them here, welcome them, spend some time with them. Because after all, all the hard work and energy goes into helping them create their family. So this is the moment that we have to cherish. And it's a moment that really is a moment that has to be embraced with a great deal of intention and thought and time.
Absolutely. And I feel like for us too, we at All Kind, we just had our first surrogacy baby that was born through via surrogacy.
Yep.
And it was 2 months ago now. So I can just imagine how after 20 plus years, how many of these experiences that you've had, which that alone motivated us. We're like, let's go out and do this 20 more times next
yes.
year. So I can definitely see how that can be incredibly rewarding. Another thing that I want to talk to you about, let's debunk a myth really quick.
Right.
When it comes to donor matching,
right,
a lot of people, and rightfully so, you know, from what you see a lot in the media, a common misconception that our community has seen, and I think is really unfair, is that traditionally or historically, they think that mainly the types of donor candidates that are being selected by either the physicians or the intended parents have to have a certain look. So whether
right.
that be a very Caucasian donor or, blonde hair, blue eyes. Can you tell us a little bit about on the matching side on your end, what actually is true and what types of donors are you looking for?
Really, the main goal for in terms of finding an egg donor or ideal egg donor is genetic health and its egg quality. Those are the two factors that are really important from a scientific perspective. And I always educate intended parents about egg donor selection. Obviously, mm-hmm. there are some characteristics that, may be More important to intended parents, whether it's ethnicity, whether mm-hmm. it's, you know, background, certain types of personalities, hobbies, interests. Although I think a significant portion of personality is really shaped by parents themselves and the environment that the children grow in, mm-hmm. Rather than actually the personality of the egg donor. But I think genetic health, looking at the family history of the egg donor in terms of whether there are any particular conditions that are recurrent, that are consecutive, you know, for example, whether it's cancers or other mm-hmm. conditions, we have terrific genetic counselors who review all the family history of the egg donors, have consultations with them to basically really screen out potential risk factors, or at least highlight potential risk factors, because you know, life is not without risk. Having a child is never without, there's never zero risk, but we do want to minimize risk. So I think genetic health, doing the genetic recessive mutation analysis, genetic counseling. There's now other types of genetic analysis, for example, PGTP mm-hmm. for polygenic types of mutations that may give us some indication of an increased risk of, for some conditions like insulin-dependent diabetes and other factors. So genetic health and then egg quality. And of course, egg quality, what we do is we perform ovarian reserve testing, antral follicle counts, hormone levels to assess the quality of eggs with an egg donor. Because whilst egg donors are all young, typically between 21 and 29, 30 years of age, there's still a variation among egg donors in regards to the number of eggs that are retrieved, the quality of those eggs, yeah. and potentially the number of blastocysts or chromosomally normal embryos that are created. So it's that discussion to be had with intended parents in terms of what kind of family they envision, how many children potentially, and whether a particular egg donor is going to fulfill their goals of creating their family.
When you're speaking with a donor and you're kind of talking them through their path, obviously a lot of times when donors have a good experience, and same for surrogates, when they have a good experience and they go through this process, they want to come back and do it again.
Right.
What do you typically recommend as sort of a cap on how many times someone should be a donor or a surrogate?
If you look at the American Society of Reproductive Medicine guidelines, you know, the maximum number of donations should be 6. Now, mm-hmm. that's not based on any long-term data or long-term research that shows, for example, beyond 6 are significant issues. But the American Society of Reproductive Medicine is being conservative mm-hmm. and saying there is a cumulative risk to egg donors. So in other words, every time they go through the egg donation process, there's less than a 0.5% risk of certain complications. And so that the more times you go through the egg donation, that cumulative risk can increase. And therefore, they want to cap it at 6. Now, there, of course, there are other considerations like consanguinity and other factors. Those are not as important because typically donors are pooled from larger populations. So consanguinity becomes less of a factor. Although again, it still has to be considered depending on the population of patients you're drawing egg donors from, and then also population of the intended parents and their sort of geography. But it's to lower risk. And I think ASRM has decided that, you know, 6 would be a factor, although we don't really have good long-term data on cumulative risk factors or on any potential effects on the donor's own fertility or mm-hmm. health. All of the evidence suggests that it is a safe procedure, and we don't have any evidence for any long-term increases, any potential medical conditions or factors.
And kind of piggybacking off of that too, when people are going through this process, you know, especially being in your early 20s, sometimes you haven't fully thought about your future and whether or not, you know, you'd like to have more children of your own. A lot of times our donors specifically, we've seen such a large pool of candidates that have had children already, which make them even better candidates for the process. But is there anything that you would say, you know, there's a potential that after you do a donor cycle, you can't have children? Or is that just another myth?
I think it's another myth, because I don't think there's any evidence that we have in terms of egg donors going through cycles, that there is any diminution of their own ovarian reserve. We talk about the physiology of egg donation. That is that after puberty, one egg, if a patient has regular menses, one egg is ovulated, matures and develops and ovulates, and then about anywhere between 200 to 500-600 eggs are lost each month. So mm-hmm. what are the things that we're doing in IVF is we're actually rescuing some of the eggs that are going to undergo what we call atresia, or programmed cell death, or apoptosis. So really there is no effect on the pool of eggs within a donor's ovaries. And again, being young, they have hundreds of thousands of eggs inside in ovaries. And it's like taking a drop from a lake. Really no evidence for a decrease in fertility for egg donors. So I think that that's a myth that there's no scientific basis for.
And I'm happy to hear it from you as well, because we've seen so many of our donors that have gone through 3-4 cycles and now are pregnant with their own children too. So it's nice to see that, okay, that is just a myth that you're hearing, but also to hear it from you, who you've done thousands of cycles and you really have such a good understanding of both sides of that.
Absolutely. I agree with you.
Well, let's end this on an interesting note. A little birdie told us that you geek out a bit on NGS, which is next generation sequencing. Right. So I'd love for us to talk a little bit about that because, you know, definitely something that our community would love to learn more about too.
Absolutely. I think, you know, DNA, and I remember back when I was at UCLA and I was as a junior at UCLA, the most fascinating course that I ever took was actually taught by a Professor Bauman. I still remember his name because he was terrific. And it was molecular biology. And he talked about DNA, RNA, proteins, transcription. And I just was fascinated. I remember taking that one lecture and then the subsequent lectures and just going back and reading it. And then, I understood it well, because I think I just absorbed it and I loved it so much that I started teaching it as well to my classmates. You know, we had these group study sessions. So, you know, DNA has always fascinated me. The field of genetics has always been fascinating. And it is also ever evolving. So years ago, we started a genetics company to look at the chromosomal normality of embryos, for example, taking the biopsy from embryos and then running a genetic analysis, a chromosomal analysis for aneuploidy, for trisomies. That company then grew, and then it was later on taken over by a larger company. And then later on, through my collaboration with one of my close friends, we were able to be involved in the generation of another company that then also served patients by looking at genetic analysis of embryos, looking at also mutations. For example, there are certain conditions that are dominant or certain recessive mutations that both the sperm and the egg provider share, so that we have to do the testing, what we call PGTM, with embryos. So that sort of evolved into next generation sequencing. And the sequencing of DNA has really evolved from sort of the early days where we really didn't have the technology that we have today, to technology that we have today where we actually can take DNA sequences of particular areas of DNA from the egg provider, from the sperm provider, and try to create a database of DNA variations, DNA mutations that could potentially explain certain types of conditions. So the field is fast evolving. It's a fascinating field, and also allows us the opportunity to potentially eliminate some genetic conditions that have been prevalent among families. I never forget one of the patients I had many, many years ago. This was probably well over 17, 18 years ago, who came in, and she had lost 2 children at a young age because of a genetic condition called spinal muscular atrophy. And I think through genetic screening, we were able to actually transfer an embryo, and she ended up having her children without spinal muscular atrophy because of that techniques that were initially developed for sequencing the mutations that are associated with spinal muscular atrophy. So this has a profound effect on the health of families, and really allows us to be able to screen embryos for genetic conditions, chromosomal abnormalities, and again, advances the field. So I am very much a geek in the field of genetics, because I love it. And I think that love was nurtured at an early age in my sort of young days at UCLA. Well, not so long, I guess.
Well, I love hearing about that. And I really appreciate your time today. And I think for our audience, it's so nice to get to have just a few minutes of time to get to understand what it would be like when they come into a fertility clinic and the access that they have to a fertility specialist. And I just want to remind everybody in the audience to advocate for yourself and to get educated about the process. Yes. Of course, at All Kind, we're going to do our best to make sure that you are you understand what you're getting involved in. But when you do have opportunities with fertility specialists, definitely take advantage of that time and make sure that all your questions are answered so you feel safe and comfortable to start this really exciting journey. And thanks again for being with us
here. Absolutely. Thank you for this opportunity.
Absolutely. Excited to partner more with you and to hopefully have you back soon.
Sounds great.
Thank you.